Candidates, start your engines. A newly opened congressional seat in Phoenix has Democrats itching with Potomac fever. Who's in, who's out, and who might be going to D.C.?
I think it will be a very competitive election that is already attracting a very strong bunch of people. I think there's going to be a wide and diverse list of candidates.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, looking back at Ed Pastor's decades in Congress and the horse race to come. Governor Brewer vetoed SB 1062 this week. We'll look at how bills like that spread from state to state.
A West Valley city is getting rid of some of its citrus, and the impact may be more than nostalgic.
And a new exhibit in Phoenix looks at messaging methods.
I think what is interesting is the ability for each individual to be a propagandist, right? Whether we like to think of ourselves as that or not.
Plus, boroughs, the bucket list, and hey, it may actually rain.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein along with Mark Brody. Quick check of Valley traffic, an accident on the 202 westbound, the Red Mountain Freeway at I-10. It's blocking the left lane. We're actually going to have some weather possibilities this weekend. It might actually rain tomorrow. I think there's a very good chance, about an 80% chance of rain tomorrow. Look for a high temperature, only to be in the mid-60s. Currently partly cloudy and 78 degrees.
Tempe passed a non-discrimination ordinance last night, but city leaders say the timing with the recently vetoed religious freedom bill was merely coincidental. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports.
The city council voted unanimously to approve an ordinance that includes sexual orientation, gender identity, and military veterans as protected from housing and employment discrimination. It applies to Tempe government, businesses, and contractors. City Attorney Judith Bauman says this law is meant to provide legal cover for people who aren't protected under state law.
Part of what we were hoping to do is fill the gap, if you will, because the state law is very effective but does not extend its protection to those groups of people.
It is a civil law that could carry fines up to $1,500. Phoenix has a similar ordinance, but it is criminal. Bauman says Tempe created a civil one because the burden of proof is lower. The statute does give some exemptions based on religion. It is the fourth city in Arizona to create such a law after Tucson, Phoenix, and Flagstaff. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News.
11-term Congressman Ed Pastor of Phoenix surprised pretty much everyone on Thursday when he announced he wouldn't be running again and would leave office in January.
That led to a lot of activity related to the 7th District House seat, namely who wants to run. People like Ruben Gallego,
Steve Gallardo,
Mary Rose Wilcox,
Pastor's daughter Laura,
former Phoenix Mayor Phil Gordon.
We could go on, but instead we turn to former state lawmaker and political activist Alfredo Gutierrez to ask about Congressman Pastor's significance as an elected official.
I think if there is a legacy going forward for the Latino community and for the state of Arizona for its future is that he broke through sort of an unwritten taboo that you don't cross that line. He broke through it and held on to the position for over two decades. And I think that is significant and important and a tremendous historical first.
Was he out front enough? Was he loud enough on some of the issues that have become more controversial, like immigration reform?
I think at the time Ed was elected, at the time it occurred, in a certain way he reflected the era. I mean, he was quiet, tough, reserved, cautious, and I think the Latino community understood that that's in fact what you had to be in order to get elected at that moment. I think as time goes on, the community demanded more and more. And Ed is who he is. He was, by all accounts, incredibly effective as a member of Appropriations and in terms of the old-fashioned bringing home the bacon. But in terms of representing the community in any aggressive fashion, that's I think where he'll be criticized and where he is criticized today. Speaking out on immigration reforms, demanding that the deportations be stopped. Arpaio, I think, is in many ways considered, especially by young people, the most egregious omission that he did not criticize early and often and stridently the actions of Arpaio.
But what would you like to see from the next representative of the 7th District?
The issue is that we not get somebody ambitious to be Speaker, ambitious to be President, ambitious to be the next U.S. Senator, and who's going to cautiously tiptoe through the issues be reading polls and trying to understand how to go forward. I think the biggest danger we fear is some ambitious young person who just wants to run into this and go to the House and play by the rules. The fact is that we have a district that playing by the rules has been horribly damaged by it.
Former state lawmaker and longtime political activist Alfredo Gutierrez. And now for what's next for the seat, we turn to Catherine Alonzo. She's partner at the consulting firm Javelina in Phoenix. Catherine, a number of people have already declared their intentions to run for this seat. There could be more names to come. So could this be a free-for-all in a sense? Could there be 9, 10, 11 candidates, and how would that affect the race?
I think it will be a very competitive election that's going to attract, and in fact is already attracting, a very strong bunch of people. I think there's going to be a wide and diverse and really strong list of candidates looking at this.
What sort of candidates for this seat make sense to you based on the names you're hearing and maybe the names we're not even hearing yet?
There's a few really strong people who are emerging already. There's Ruben Gallego, who is an elected House representative in the district. He is an Iraq War veteran, Harvard graduate. He has a really deep grassroots network in the district, has proven himself to be a strong fundraiser, strong campaigner, and recently just took a very prominent role in the fight against SB 1062 at our legislature, so really has a very strong base. There's others, several people currently sitting on the Phoenix City Council have been rumored, Daniel Valenzuela, Laura Pastor, who have really strong roots in the district. And then there's Mary Rose Wilcox, who currently sits on the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, who, again, I think has been perceived to be waiting to be for the seat to be open and poised to run for quite some time.
I'm glad you brought up Supervisor Wilcox. She's someone that has been talked about for this seat. You mentioned Ruben Gallego, you mentioned Laura Pastor and Daniel Valenzuela. They are much younger than Mary Rose Wilcox. Does age make a difference here? Is there a feeling that one would want someone younger, bringing more energy and perhaps many more years in that seat?
That's such an interesting question. I'm not sure that age particularly matters. I think that it's the person that will end up being successful in this primary is the one that has the most fresh perspectives and new ideas to bring to the table.
There's been talk for many, many years about how the Democratic bench in the Valley in Arizona just isn't that deep. Is this going to change that? Are we going to get more candidates that people will hear of, even those who don't win in the primary? And could that be a real positive for the Democratic Party?
Quite possibly. And I think that a strong primary is always an asset to the Democratic Party. The other thing, of course, is the vacancies that will be opened up in other branches of government and in other seats when the people that currently hold those seats decide to run for Congress. And so there's a ripple effect in that there will be people looking at running for open seats that have appeared overnight. And that definitely, it strengthens the list of candidates out there, it strengthens the party, and it really is definitely very good in the long run.
Catherine Alonzo is partner at the public affairs firm Javelina. Catherine, thanks for the time today.
Thank you.
It's time to step out onto the ledge with the goings-on at the state capitol, and it was, you know, another quiet week for the legislature, not much going on there.
Yeah, unless you count ongoing protests and international news coverage as something other than quiet.
Right. With her veto Wednesday evening, Governor Jan Brewer ended the suspense over Senate Bill 1062, the religious freedom bill, and the controversy that found its way to Arizona has led some other states to take another look at their versions of the measure. For more on that, we welcome Molly Jackman, an assistant professor in political science at Vanderbilt University. In general, how prevalent is it for groups, ALEC or otherwise, to try to get similar or the same bills passed in multiple states?
It's actually pretty common. There are national organizations like ALEC that do this, and then there's also organizations that are at the state level that help craft model legislation and then shop them to like-minded sponsors. So, for example, in the case of Arizona, the bill that we're all talking about, Senate Bill 1062, it was written by the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is a national organization, but they worked with the Center for Arizona Policy, which is a local Arizona organization. So it's not uncommon for national organizations to collaborate with state organizations or for state organizations to have a hand in writing legislation themselves.
So when a national group works with a state-based group, do the bills tend to be somewhat different or maybe more tailored to a particular state than if, for example, Alliance Defending Freedom just sent out one bill to everybody?
I don't think so. I mean, I can't speak to that very broadly, but I know in this case that the Alliance Defending Freedom was working from... Their starting off point was to say, this is an issue that a lot of states are confronting. It's the issue of bakers not wanting to make cakes for gay marriages and photographers not wanting to photograph gay marriages. And this is an issue that can be broadly applied across states, and Arizona is a good place to start the ball rolling. So I think that they go in wanting to make this a national issue and choosing states that'll be the best, most receptive platforms.
And how do they pick that?
Well, they tend to target states that are going to be like-minded, so it's not a surprise that they started off in Arizona, which is a more conservative state. And you also see more model legislation in non-professionalized legislatures. So in professionalized legislatures, legislators tend to have huge staffs that can help them write bills and gain expertise. But model bills tend to be introduced more frequently in citizen or hybrid legislatures, where legislators don't have that kind of support.
Do you foresee model legislation, this concept of bills being formulated and then disseminated to states, continuing, or do you think that at some point it's gonna stop a little bit?
It's a really interesting question. The idea that bills would disseminate across state borders is not new. I think Justice Brandeis said he described states as laboratories for policy experimentation, and there's been a ton of research in political science about how bills diffuse across state borders on everything from minimum wage to anti-smoking laws. So this process of policy diffusion across states, of a bill being introduced and then being picked up, it's been going on forever, and we don't really think of it as a bad thing. I think we can think of organizations like ALEC or the Alliance for Defending Freedom more of as greasing the wheels for the process to occur. And I don't think that will stop, especially since it's such a benefit to legislators in non-professionalized legislatures to have kind of a standard by which to enact a bill and to make sure that there's some expertise behind that bill. I think there's a lot of stigma because these organizations are so ideologically loaded. And I think that increased transparency on the part of the organization will help to decrease that stigma and restore this idea of policy experimentation rather than this sort of corporate negative affiliation that these organizations have taken on.
Molly Jackman is an assistant professor in political science at Vanderbilt University. Glendale Mayor Jerry Wyers delivered his State of the City address last night, and the news wasn't great. The city's financial issues have been well documented, including with the Coyotes, Camelback Ranch, and the Super Bowl. Wyers says there's no sense beating around the bush about it.
We have some serious problems, and I don't believe in sugarcoating things. Say it the way it is, give the details as far as what's going on, and then offer some opportunities for solutions.
What do you think the city has to do to try to fix its budget problems?
Well, we have a lot of different things that we have to do. It's not a one fix solution. We have staff kind of spread out throughout the city. We can move more staff back, kind of condensing everybody. That opens some assets that we might be able to sell and get rid of some debt that we no longer have future expenses on. Making sure that we do everything in our power to attract businesses to Glendale.
Do you foresee having to cut spending in Glendale?
Well, absolutely, sir. We've been cutting spending. They started that before I became mayor a year ago, and we're still doing that now. There are some departments that we're going to have to look at the facts of whether we need to privatize or get rid of them altogether. But, almost 50% of our entire budget is public safety by itself. And then you start looking at the debt load, the amount of money that we owe, the contractual obligations that we can't get out of. Those two combined is a huge portion of money that we have to have, and it really, really narrows it down to where, we're not cutting meat anymore. We're cutting through the bone. I mean, not cutting bone, but cutting through the bone.
How much do you attribute the financial problems that Glendale is facing right now to its building and recruitment boon with sports and entertainment?
Well, everything's combined. I mean, sports venues that we have, potentially things are good, can be a huge income for the city. Right now, they're a drain on the city.
What do you think the value would be to Glendale to get an event like the Final Four? And I ask because Glendale obviously will have the Super Bowl next year, but at the same time, the city's asking for some money from the state to help pay for public safety. So what's the value of bringing in some of these big events if the city's not able to totally pay for them?
Well, let me be clear on one thing, and hopefully your listeners. The city is not making bids on any of these events. We didn't bid the Super Bowl. We're not bidding the Final Four. Those are done by host committees that other folks are doing. We have to make the agreement that that if, in fact, you're going to bid it, that we're willing to step up and pay the public safety portion of it, which is fine if you can prove to your taxpayers that you're bringing in more revenues than you're spending. And that's the problem right now. The sporting venues are not doing that.
Glendale Mayor Jerry Wires. The U.S. Census Bureau this week came out with some new numbers on housing. Among the findings, the vacancy rate for rental housing in Arizona was almost 11% last year, higher than the national average. But Pete Tecamp isn't sure about that number. He's with the firm Marcus & Millichap and says the census numbers are probably too broad and look at too long a time frame. He prefers to study the Valley's rental market quarter by quarter.
The fourth quarter of 13 is the 16th consecutive quarter that vacancies fell over the same period of the prior year. I don't know that has ever occurred in the Phoenix metro area, but right now our vacancy stands at 7.9%, and that's the second consecutive quarter that vacancies were under 8. And, you know, we were as high as 15.7% when our market was really having a tough time about 3 years ago.
It seems like there are a lot of new apartments being built in the Valley now. How do you reconcile having a vacancy rate that's higher than maybe some people would like it to be, and you're adding new units at the same time?
When our market was at its healthiest in 2005 and 6 and back in the 1999-2000 time frame, our vacancy across the Valley was a healthy 7.5%. It's going to be fascinating to see how the market reacts to the new inventory that's coming online. Last year, 2013, we built 18 apartment buildings that comprised 3,727 units. And 55% of those units were in the cities of Tempe and Scottsdale.
So do you think that there are enough potential renters to fill all those 3,000-some-odd new units that opened in the last year?
I hope so. Our economic situation is better than it was 3 years ago, so there's fewer of the doubling up, the roommate situations, or maybe people moving back home and now they want to get out on their own. And, you know, there's a lot of talk and chatter in my industry about how many units are coming. But what actually was built last year was a lot less than a lot of experts forecasted to be.
Do you have an estimate as to how many new units might come online in 2014?
Yeah, I mean, early right now, there's about 5,600 to 5,800 units, so just under 6,000 that are either scheduled for or under construction. And I'm going to say that we'll probably add somewhere between, and not all of those will get built, but I think that we're going to be right around 5,000 this year.
Does the Valley's rental stock, including some of these new units that are going to be coming, represent a diversity of location, income, rental levels, that sort of thing, or do they tend to be more on the high end or the low end?
Most, not all, but most, and I would say better than 90% of the new units coming online have catered to the upper end of the rental scale. And the lower end of the socioeconomic scale has been, and I think continues to be, severely underserved, because those submarkets where there are existing buildings are now seeing vacancies plummet. There's a lot of demand.
Pete Tecamp is a commercial real estate agent with the firm Marcus & Millichap.
Still to come, federal investigators are trying to solve more than a dozen shootings in the desert.
Once you're out there, there's no witnesses. You get people taking pot shots. Sad to say, but it's one of the realities here in the Wild West.
Why federal protection isn't working. The story is ahead on the show. Rain is likely tonight around the Valley. We haven't been able to say that in more than 2 months. Look for overnight lows to be around 60. Then for tomorrow, an 80% chance for rain. Could be 3/4 of an inch. Look for a high of 66. It's currently 78 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by SRP Trees for Change. Help take action to reforest Arizona land destroyed by fire. Learn more at srptreesforchange.com.
Arizona officials have long worried about human trafficking, and with the Super Bowl coming to Glendale next year, those efforts are expected to ramp up even more. This week, the State House of Representatives unanimously approved a bill that would expand the definition of racketeering to include human trafficking. Luis Sidibaca is President Obama's senior advisor on human trafficking issues and is in the Valley today to talk about the state's work in that area.
We recognize that it's not simply a fight that we have to be doing out in Angola or Azerbaijan. We need to be doing it in Arizona and the other states. And so my office, actually, even though we're at the State Department, we have a coordinating function for the fight against human trafficking here in the United States. And, you know, we use this term human trafficking, and I think a lot of people are familiar with it, or they think they are because they've seen it in movies or what have you. But really what we're talking about is modern slavery.
And this issue has been getting a lot of attention in Arizona in advance, especially in advance of next year's Super Bowl. Events like that seem to sort of bring out these kinds of problems, perhaps more so than they're there normally.
I think that, you know, one of the things that we saw in New Jersey in the last couple of weeks was a spike in the number of folks who were arrested, and more importantly to me, the number of victims that were identified, children that were saved from the pimps. That's something that we certainly want to make sure that Phoenix is prepared for, that the folks here in Arizona are prepared for that next year. But we also have to remember that Super Bowl Sunday is one day a year. And we have to make sure that after the media tents get taken down and after everybody goes back to their hometowns, human trafficking needs to be fought in Arizona for the rest of 2015 and into 2016 and beyond. And I think that's why we're so excited about what we've been seeing in Arizona with the building up of the state task force that Governor Brewer announced last year. Over this last week, there's been action in the State House, unanimous passing of a bill.
Yeah, the bill would basically add trafficking to the definition of racketeering, among some other provisions in there.
Indeed, and it's something that I think that we saw both Democrats and Republicans being able to come together on, which, you know, we see this in Washington. Anything that we can do to bridge what sometimes seems like intractable partisan divisions, there does seem to be a consensus, thank God, in the United States that we should all come together to fight against this old evil of modern slavery.
What are some of the challenges that a place like Arizona or, and to an extent, probably California face in dealing with these issues given our proximity to the border?
I think one of the hardest things for countries to do, and it's not just here in the United States but around the world, is to try to screen and identify people who are in violation of the immigration laws to figure out who are the people who are refugees, who are the people that are unaccompanied children, who are the people that are victims of human trafficking. And it's difficult because in some ways, people don't know that they're going to be a victim of human trafficking when they're in transit. So I think it's critically important not just to be thinking about the border, but then also to be thinking about where do people end up.
Luis Sidibaca is Ambassador at Large to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons with the U.S. State Department. Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much.
Thank you.
KJZZ commentator Robert Pala has been caring for his mother, who has Alzheimer's disease, for the past 7 years. As her primary caregiver, he has a lot of time to consider the more unfortunate details of caregiving.
Yesterday, my mother had an appointment with her oncologist. Last week, I took her to see her general practitioner. Next Thursday, we're off to the neurologist. If I don't look forward to the endless visits to specialists and primary care docs, it's not because of the schlepping back and forth to Sun City, or the fact that a lot of the time lately, my car smells like old people. It's not filling out the same forms I've filled out last month, or the inevitability that the test results from our previous visit have been misplaced. It's not even my mother's repeated questions. Why are we here? What's a checkup? What if the doctor asks for money? I don't have my purse with me. It's the pens. At some point, someone decided that ink pens on doctor's office reception desks needed to have silk flowers glued to the ends of them, then shoved into cunning little vases filled with colored marbles. Nearly every one of the half dozen or so doctors I take my mother to see has a clever arrangement of polyester petunias and fake tea roses next to the sign-in clipboard. And because I always forget that Bix are now begonias, I stand there looking for something to write with, at which point the receptionist before me inevitably chirps, "The flowers are pens." This makes me want to kill myself. I deplore random cuteness, and I can't fathom either the purpose in this peculiar trend or where it came from. Did an orthopedist's receptionist in Avondale see a cute photo in a fun crafts magazine of a uniball with a daffodil stuck to it and just go nuts with it? Did other receptionists then steal the idea, turning every waiting room in every West Valley doctor's office into a plasticine bowery? What's next? Tourniquets fashioned into wrist corsages? Prescription forms folded into origami impatiens? Will the nurse at the orthopedist office ask my mother to please go into the other room and sweet pea into a flower bowl? I have a theory about why this silly craze continues. I think the flower pens are happening because receptionists feel inadequate. Surrounded by people who can save lives, they spend their days asking for insurance cards and adjusting the waiting room thermostat. By camouflaging their pens as a bouquet of bachelor buttons, they get to feel superior about something. After watching us look everywhere for something to sign in with, they can roll their eyes and say, "The flowers are pens." So I'm dreading Mom's Thursday visit to the urologist, but I have a plan. When the receptionist asks me for my copay, I'm going to hand her a fistful of baby's breath and a wad of floral clay. For KJZZ, I'm Robert Pala.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Will Tucker, and I'm rehearsing with the Phoenix Youth Symphony. We play challenging repertoire, and we're always working. I rehearse every night of the week, but I try to practice where I don't rehearse. And, you know, it adds up quickly. A lot of weeks, even, you know, 15 hours. I always wanted to play the horn, and my band director back in grade school said, "Horn's a very difficult instrument, are you sure?" And I said, "Nah." And he said, "Let's give you the euphonium." And then the switch from euphonium to bass tuba is very easy. And so just 1 year later, I was playing bass tuba. It's the instrument for me.
That's Will Tucker, an 18-year-old tuba player for Phoenix Youth Symphony, rehearsing for the side-by-side concert at Phoenix Symphony Hall. He was practicing at Central High School in Phoenix. If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark. I'm Steve. Quick check of Valley traffic at this hour. Accidents on the 101 westbound at 75th Avenue. Also a troublesome accident, I-10 westbound at the 202. It's blocking the exit ramp.
KJZZ is supported by ASU's Trilateral Borders Conference, NAFTA at 20 years, March 16th through 18th. Business leaders, policymakers, and scholars discuss trade and border issues. Registration at trilateralborders.org.
Mark, it's that time again, an increasingly rare time, when you and I try to figure out what that wet substance falling from the sky is.
Steve, I'm pretty sure it's called rain.
And it's something we haven't seen in the Valley for 70 days. Gary Woodall, chief meteorologist in charge of Phoenix's National Weather Service office, says that should change tonight.
December 20th was the last measurable rainfall, and compounding that is the case that January and February are typically two of our wetter months during the cool season, so it's really been aggravating the situation. The good news, though, is that some relief may be on the way, it looks like, is almost definitely on the way. Probably late tonight through most of the day on Saturday will be when we see the bulk of the precipitation.
Considering what you said about January and February usually being wet months, how much rain would we need to make up for what we've lost in the last 7 or 8 weeks?
Typically, in January, we see about 91 hundredths of an inch, and February, about 92 hundredths. So just about 2 inches, 1.9 or so, we'd need to, we've fallen behind. It doesn't look like we're going to see that much with this event, but we should see around an inch or so here in the Phoenix area, maybe a little bit more than that.
What about the next storm? Are we seeing anything in the next 7 to 10 days after this one?
It doesn't look like it at this point, at least looking out through the mid to latter portion of next week. This is probably going to pretty much be it for us for the short term anyway, unfortunately.
That's Gary Woodall, chief meteorologist in charge of Phoenix's National Weather Service office. And I wonder, still I wonder, who'll stop the rain. Federal investigators here in Arizona have a mystery on their hands. Since 2009, 18 shootings in the desert outside of Phoenix. KJZZ's Peter O'Dowd reports on the unsolved crimes.
Let's get something straight here. We're talking about donkeys, wild burros, the federally protected asses of the Old West. In late January, two more from the Lake Pleasant herd were found dead among the desert scrub and beaver tail cactus.
We consider that a murder scene.
The Bureau of Land Management's Steve Bird drove me there. About 35 miles northwest of Phoenix, the dirt road stops at a gate. We get out and stand on the spot where someone took aim.
It was a skilled hunter, or a skilled shooter. One bullet hole per animal, right set in the lungs. It was a good shot.
These burros descend from pack animals that gold miners abandoned more than a century ago. Today, the feral herd drinks from Lake Pleasant each morning and then scrambles back into these hills to spend the afternoon. In 2012, 5 burros were killed in one day. 11 were shot in a single barrage back in 2009. Bill Clinton was president the last time anyone got caught.
And this is something that you just let die out here, that's just not right.
Because nobody eats a burro, right? And in no cases did anybody look like they were harvesting the meat.
No, not at all.
The BLM believes the motive is nothing more than target shooting.
What was that?
We just heard a gunshot off to the east.
Probably a hunter, probably not shooting burros.
Come on, get! Get!
It's about time you actually met a wild burro, so let's take a trip north to Oatman, Arizona, where burros stick their noses into the outstretched hands of tourists. Gunfighting actors have learned how to nudge the stubbornly tame beast from the road.
If you have water, just kind of splash it in their face and they'll leave.
And that's why a burro is vulnerable.
It doesn't even move. It just stands there and looks at you. And then it's just like a stationary target.
To Oatman resident Jim Quinn, it's no surprise that people are shooting the animals near Phoenix. He says they do it up here, too.
Once you're out there, there's no witnesses. You get people taking pot shots. Sad to say, but it's one of the realities here in the Wild West.
There is a federal law that's supposed to protect the burros because they're seen as a symbol of the American West. Quinn points to the mountains around town and shows me the remnants of so many gold mines.
The burros was like the middle-class, blue-collar labor of America. Without the burros, a lot of things couldn't have gotten done.
Whoever shot the burros near Phoenix faces a year in prison. For now, federal authorities don't have much to go on. Peter O'Dowd, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
If you've spent any time in downtown Phoenix over the last few years, you've probably passed empty lots being developed and old buildings getting new life. Things look a lot different today. New construction and redevelopment have changed both the city's skyline and, to an extent, its vibe. Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton will be taking the stage tomorrow night at the Crescent Ballroom to talk about downtown's transformation.
It's going to be my opportunity to talk about really how we've changed the decision-making process in downtown, and that is the creation of this new downtown organizing body called Downtown Phoenix, Inc., in which I said no longer are the artists and entrepreneurs, small business owners, the people really creating the energy and excitement of downtown, not going to be part of the decision-making. You talk to some of those small businesses, or talk to leaders of Roosevelt Row, talk to some of the people on Grand Avenue, the exciting things. They feel like they are now listened to, and their opinions really matter for the future of downtown. And here's the reason why. Because downtown is becoming a neighborhood. Not a part of the city where you might go for your job during the day and leave at night. Not a part of the city where you might go for a ball game or an arts event and then go home at night. Downtown is becoming a place where more and more people are living. So we've got to turn it into a real neighborhood that's walkable, that's bikeable. And so in addition to kind of building new stuff, which of course we're going to have a lot of that, and some of it's ongoing right now as we speak, we also want to have life and vibrancy, really create excitement, play, an exciting place that people want to live 24/7.
Is it a balancing act for you and for the other council members to try to make sure that downtown is all of the things that you want it to be while also making sure that it doesn't sort of suck the air out of the rest of the city?
Not at all. And anybody that makes that argument, it's not true. The reality is that a great downtown is huge for the entire city, the entire valley, the entire state of Arizona. We need a great downtown, a vibrant downtown with lots of hotels and conventions and sporting events with lots of people. When you support downtown and the educational advancements that we've made, the scientific advancements that we have made, the artistic advancements, all of the above, when you support that, you are supporting increasing the quality of life for all the people of our community. So it's not an either-or proposition.
So looking forward now, do you want to continue doing what you're doing? Are there things that you need to maybe tweak with how you've been approaching downtown, anything like that?
Well, let me be perfectly frank. Because downtown is becoming a neighborhood, we need to rethink a lot of things. We've got to change some of the traffic patterns in downtown. There's so many one-way streets in downtown which are really there to help people from other parts of the valley get in and out quickly. We need to rethink whether that's the right strategy. So because downtown is becoming a neighborhood, that we need to rethink how the city planning for the area must change along with it.
Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
It's lunchtime in downtown Phoenix, and there are a lot of places to choose from, but only one offers lunch and a show.
Welcome to Harlem, New York. Smack dab in the middle of 1920.
The CAC stage in the Herberger Theater Center has about 100 seats that fill up quickly just before noon.
It's a day out and fun. We get a free lunch. It's wonderful.
June Keegan guesses she's been coming to lunchtime theater shows for 5 or 6 years. The Senior Center, where she lives in Paradise Valley, offers lunch and a bus ride to the theater. But the show is open to anyone with 45 minutes to spare Tuesdays through Thursdays. And it's all run by this woman.
Judy Rawlings is the Director of Art Education and Outreach at the Herberger. Besides pumping up the crowd before each show, Rawlings has run the lunchtime program since it started 13 years ago. When Rawlings started, the theater was filled with performance companies, and she noticed something.
There was no more room. We had so many resident companies at that point that there was no way to include any new talent.
So the CAX stage was created. It's an intimate venue where performers act on the floor 5 feet away from the front row, and where small theater companies have a half hour in the spotlight.
And with the ticket price of $6, we do not make a profit. We probably break even, given the fact that we have some wonderful donations.
Donations help pay for props, costumes, and other costs. And this is important, Rawlings says, because what often keeps a small theater company from the main stage is how expensive it is, even just to rent the space.
But the concept wasn't just for the performance companies. Rawlings says originally she wanted to find a way to bring a cultural event to workers downtown. And now, she says, many retired people come because they prefer the time and cheaper price compared to evening performances. The performers and playwrights work hard to put on the half-hour shows, some humorous, some thought-provoking. And Rawlings says some have gone from the CAC stage to bigger venues.
Next week, they're taking a different approach with an abridged dance performance as a preview for their new show called Secrets. You can bring a lunch like the Paradise Valley Seniors or even pre-order one through the theater. A calendar of shows is at herberger-theater.org.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown. When you've got worries, all the noise and the hurry seems to help, I know. Downtown, just listen to the music of the traffic.
Good afternoon, it's the show on KJZZ. Couple problems on the Valley roadways. I-10 westbound, accident at the 202. 202 westbound Red Mountain Freeway at 24th Street. And on the 101 southbound in the East Valley at University. Cloudy skies, rain likely tonight into tomorrow. Look for overnight lows tonight around 60. It's 78 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by Mesa Arts Center. Direct from PBS, political comedian Mark Russell jokes, sings, plays piano, and pokes fun at The Absurd in American Democracy, March 8th. Mark Russell tickets at MesaArtsCenter.com.
A neighborhood in Sun City is saying goodbye to one of Arizona's legendary five C's, citrus, and replacing orange trees with xeriscape and plants like lantana and ocotillo that use less water. But the presence of citrus trees can provide some cooling respite from our sizzling summers and even the urban heat island effect. Nancy Sellover is state climatologist for Arizona.
It kind of depends on what else they have in their landscape besides the tree itself. What I mean by that is historically a lot of the citrus areas were down in central Phoenix along Camelback Road. There'd be a lot of orchards, and people would flood irrigate them. Tempe has a lot of them as well. They'd be flood irrigated, so there was all grass. And so it was a very lush, sort of humid environment. And now we have a lot of people who have citrus trees, and those trees are in areas where the landscape underneath them is not vegetated. It's gravel, some of the new xeriscape type things. So it's a little bit different because if you remove the tree from an area where you have turf grass, you still have some of that cooling effect of the vegetation. If you remove it from an area where you have the gravel or the xeriscape, you don't have that cooling effect of the vegetation. But then, are you removing it and replacing it with some other kind of a tree that maybe uses less water, or are you just removing it? There's a lot of variables here.
How do we decide what works in this environment?
That's a very difficult question. Once you get an established tree where you have a fairly large canopy, so you're putting in Palo Verde or mesquite or ironwood or some other native species that has a pretty small leaf, if it's got a large canopy size, it's shading the ground. And that's kind of the most important part, is it providing shade so the sun doesn't heat up whatever's on the surface. And that, of course, that's more important if what's on the surface is gravel or desert landscaping than if it's on, than it's turf. So that's really key, is how much shade is it providing. And if it can shade your house as well, that's really good.
State climatologist Nancy Sellover. But what if we're just being nostalgic? Does losing citrus trees mean we're actually losing something deeper? Philip Vandermeer is a history professor at ASU.
What's really important about this is its image, its presentation of the state. Arizona is one of only four states that's growing citrus, and it really reflects a sense of an alternative climate and lifestyle. It's exotic in a sense. So that early on, Arizona is being presented consciously, in fact, to the rest of the nation as a different kind of place. So tourists are attracted to the state, and there's a consistent effort to present Arizona as a place of sunshine, and citrus fits into that.
What are we losing by losing some of the citrus?
In Arcadia and that north central Phoenix area, as well as places in Mesa, these are the areas of citrus groves. They're unique landscapes in the valley in particular. Now, of course, other people planted trees. There are citrus groves or patches in lots of places. ASU campus has areas. They're unique in that sense, and seeing them disappear really reflects a transformation in the history of this place, how it's presented itself to not only to the nation, but to people who came here. Swimming pools and citrus trees are options for new residents, and taking them out really cuts some of the ties with that history.
Philip Vandermeer, history professor at ASU, as we try to turn lemons into lemonade here on the show. The Alcatraz Federal Penitentiary was once the world's most notorious prison. Set on a rocky outcrop in San Francisco Bay, it was feared by even the toughest of criminals. But scientists say there's more to the rock's history than crime and punishment. They've discovered the remains of a military fort that dates back to the Civil War. The BBC's science correspondent, Rebecca Morrell, has been to the island to uncover the mystery.
Alcatraz, the rock, the mighty escape-proof jail in San Francisco Bay, dreaded by every American lawbreaker. It is dusk, And within the prison, a mutiny of hardened, life-term killers has become war to the death.
Well, we've just got on the boat and we're heading out across San Francisco Bay. It's a beautiful day here. You can see the Golden Gate Bridge in the distance. And we're going towards Alcatraz. From the 1930s to the 1960s, this was one of the world's most infamous prisons. Inmates included Al Capone, Mickey Cohen, a veritable who's who of the criminal underworld. But scientists here are investigating the hidden history of the Rock.
We are standing in the middle of the recreation yard, right here where all the prisoners did their exercise.
Professor Mark Everett is from Texas A&M University. Got quite a strange setup. You've got students marching up and down in very straight lines, carrying this weird contraption.
Okay, well, that's ground-penetrating radar. So we're basically moving along with a cart, which has a transmitter and a receiver. And then it sends an electromagnetic wave into the ground, which then reflects off all the different structures underneath, much like a medical imaging would make a scan of the body. We're making a scan of the ground under the rec yard.
Using this technique, the team has made a remarkable discovery. They've found the hidden remains of a 150-year-old military fortress that they thought had been destroyed.
I think most people know that in 1848, gold was discovered in California. And before that time, San Francisco was really a very small town.
Jason Hagen is the historic architect for the National Park Service.
Once gold was discovered here, San Francisco became a very important port for the country, for the West Coast. And so protecting that port really was the point of building the fortress of Alcatraz.
If the team is right, archaeologists will soon start excavating. Jason Hagen is keen to bring the Rock's military past out into the open.
The fortification history is something that is really important to the historic significance of the island itself. So in that sense, it's really important to sort of give people a sense of the early part of the island's history.
The BBC's Rebecca Morrell.
Walk through the Burton Barr Central Library in Phoenix and you'll be transported back to the 1930s. A new exhibit opened this week called State of Deception, The Power of Nazi Propaganda. But Carl Kendall, the library's deputy director of collections and programming, says it's not just about the past.
Well, I think there's the importance historically of the topic, but also relating propaganda to life today and the fact that we're still bombarded with all these messages. And hopefully an exhibit like this helps people learn how to better decipher, wade through those messages and figure out for themselves what is true and what is not.
This is a traveling show from the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in D.C. Phoenix is its second stop. The museum's Joanna Wasserman shows me around the photos and reproduced propaganda posters. She says Hitler believed propaganda helped cost Germany World War I, which in part led to his use of it in the lead-up to World War II.
I think what's really interesting and what you see emphasized in this exhibit is how much more advanced they were than everyone else at the time. So part of it was their messaging, and part of it was also their use of new technologies, which they really smartly began to use.
You almost hate to have to ask a question like this, but it seems like since World War II and since the Nazis' rise and then eventual fall, a lot of what they did has been adopted by almost everybody, it seems, trying to get any kind of message out.
Well, and they also studied what had been done before, right? So Hitler was a student of propaganda. Yes, it's an art, and people study it, and they adopt techniques that work. But, for example, right here, you see a wall of posters targeting different audiences, really segmenting the different audiences and tailoring the message to what would have been appealing to those audiences at the time. And that's something we're used to seeing all the time now, but it was really sort of cutting edge at the time.
When people walk through this exhibit, what do you ideally hope that they take away from it after having seen it?
We've got a lot of goals. What I would hope that people do is think about propaganda relative to themselves.
I would imagine, especially now, given all the different media that are out there that we see every day, it seems like this could be a particularly maybe salient point for people right now, especially here in Arizona right now with all the messaging we're having going on with a particular piece of legislation at the Capitol?
Well, I think what visitors are surprised by and astounded by is the Nazi complete control of the media, right? And I think what people today experience is sort of an inverse challenge in the same way, which is that there are so many media, there are so many competing messages, it feels overwhelming.
Wasserman says it can be tough to figure out what to believe, especially with social media adding to the traditional ones. She says the Nazis worked hard to cultivate grassroots propaganda, and that while it's not an exact comparison, there are some similarities to today.
I don't know that we get that level of organization with social media today. I think it takes on sort of a life of its own. But I think what is interesting is the ability for each individual to be a propagandist, right? Whether we like to think of ourselves as that or not.
Burton Barr Library is the first such facility to host the exhibit. It had been at the Field Museum in Chicago before coming here. The library's Carl Kendall says public libraries are good spots for exhibits like this.
There's 80,000 people that come through these doors at this facility every month, and so the potential impact is very great.
State of Deception, the Power of Nazi Propaganda, will be on display through June 1st at Burton Barr Central Library in Phoenix. We're teaming up with Robert Pala and Amy Silverman of New Times on a list of things you've got to do in Phoenix before you die. We've been to Metro Center, Barrio Cafe, and Cosanti. This afternoon, Steve and Robert go underground.
There's a short stretch of Camelback Road between 22nd and 24th Streets where you can cross via a tunnel.
And it is underground in part, I think, because there were some pedestrians who had to take their lives into their own hands trying to get across.
And also because it's really groovy. You know, one of the reasons that I put this on my bucket list is because it's so not Phoenix. We're walking under Camelback Road right now. Any other city, it would just be a walkway. Usually right here, particularly in the evenings, on the weekends, there's somebody set up singing or playing the banjo or, a synthesizer or something. So, you know, there's a little entertainment down here at night sometimes.
Unfortunately, the tunnel was quiet during our visit. No live music, not even any whistling. What are we walking on here?
This is a mosaic tile installation, also known as the floor. And it's floral with a whole ton of art history references. And it's lovely. It's, you know, it's made for high traffic. So it's actually public art that won't be damaged by 30 or 40 years worth of walking on it. And then you come up here, this gorgeous staircase, and there's a sculpture and a water feature, and then you're in a shopping mall, and it's back to Phoenix again.
And now Robert and I have moved. We've survived the underground tunnel. We are now in the lobby at the Arizona Biltmore. I'm not a big fan of the word iconic, but this is one of the iconic places in Phoenix.
It is. This is one of the places that everybody who knows anything about Phoenix knows about. It's beautiful, and it has a pedigree, and it's surrounded by golf courses, and it's a resort in a resort town. And, it's no wonder that everybody insists that this is a Frank Lloyd Wright building. Look around. All of these details are deliberately references to Wright, who did not, of course, design or have a hand in this building. He was a consultant for 4 months. You know, there's a great deal of confusion. And then in the 70s, when they started adding on and rebuilding and remodeling here, there were more and more Frank Lloyd Wright touches added. And to further confuse matters, there's a restaurant that's been here since the 90s called Wright's.
Is there a particular time of year you prefer to be here?
I like being here in the wintertime. But that's partly because I don't ever leave the house in the summertime. So from April until October, I'm pretty much a shut-in. And then, you know, in November, it's nice to be here.
Why did this become one of your favorites? Why is this on the bucket list?
I come here because it's one of the few really gorgeous lobbies where you can sit in the lobby for hours on end and not have to be a guest or feel peculiar about hanging out in the lobby, because look, we're surrounded by bars. So you sit down here and someone notices and they come out and offer you a drink, which is also nice.
Can you imagine everyone who's lived in Phoenix for any time, this should be on the bucket list?
I don't know if locals come here. I hope so. This is, you know, people presumably live in Phoenix because they like the Southwest, and this is very Southwestern. Look, right there, there's a sculpture, a plaster sculpture of a horse with a cowboy on top of it. So, come on. It's a horse and rider sculpture in the lobby of the Biltmore, which wasn't designed by Frank Lloyd Wright.
Well, right or wrong, the Biltmore lobby lets us check off another entry of the New Times bucket list.
If there was an award for the world's best backyard, the place we're taking you to next would have to be a front runner. It's in the desert near the Picket Post Mountain outside of Superior, and has become a huge attraction. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez takes us there.
The Boyce Thompson Arboretum was founded in 1924. It's home to thousands of plants, trees, and animals. Did you know the Boyce Thompson Arboretum is Arizona's oldest and largest public garden and one of the four oldest west of the Mississippi?
Because of our terrain, we're at 2,400 feet, we can actually grow a broader variety of plants because we have some warm spots and we have some cold spots.
Mark Siegworth is the Arboretum director. He took me on a tour of the land.
So compared to like maybe parts of Phoenix where it's all the same, we have all these nooks and crannies where we can see if the different plants will weather there better or not.
There are more than 2,600 types of plants here from all over the world. It's like a global forest adventure. The trail goes through an Australian desert collection, considered one of the largest assortments of plants from down under in North America. The walk continues through a cactus garden, a eucalyptus grove, and into South American and African exhibits. Hundreds of mammals, birds, reptiles, and amphibians hang around here. There's a chance you could see skunks, rabbits, Gila monsters, and squirrels. And lurking in the hills are javelinas, bobcats, foxes, and vultures.
He's acting like he's feeding, though.
It's not uncommon to see people walking around here with binoculars. They're bird watchers.
Burden.
He could be feeding with
a burden.
The Audubon has designated this an important bird area because of the more than 230 species that live or migrate through here. During my visit, a cardinal swooped over my head.
Oh, bird. What bird is that?
People are fascinated by cardinals, and we have a lot of them out here.
Really? That was a cardinal?
But it's the plants and trees that attract visitors, including the thin and spiny Baja California bujum tree and the largest red gum eucalyptus tree in the U.S. Sigworth says it's about 100 feet tall.
Because this was planted here in 1926. I have pictures of it when it was just a sapling here. And so we call it Mr. Big. And yes, that is a big tree.
The arboretum was originally William Boyce Thompson's backyard. The Montana native owned two copper mining companies in Globe and Superior. He loved it here so much that in 1924, he built his winter home on a hill overlooking nearby Queen Creek. To spruce up the area, he hired two U of A plant scientists. Because of the variety of trees and plants, it quickly became a research facility. In 1927, the Boyce Thompson Southwest Arboretum became the first nonprofit research agency in Arizona.
He actually donated his home in, I think, 1928 to the Arboretum. He donated the home and everything. But, you know, sadly, he died in 1930, so he didn't get to enjoy this as much as he would have thought.
Since 1976, the Boyce Thompson Arboretum has been an Arizona State Park and part of the U of A College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. The latest plan to ensure its reputation as a serene desert oasis involves moving the adjacent Route 60 to the other side of the hill. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
You've been listening to the show on 91.5 KJZZ. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great weekend.